everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I am happy to welcome my other co-hosts. First, he is the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com, as well as the co-host of the TV Break podcast, Alex Marcus. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Justin. I just thought there would be more.
Ah, yes, the eternal struggle. Yeah, well, hopefully we'll fill that to some extent on this episode for you. So introducing our next co-host, hopefully he can bring us some of the more that you're referring to. The co-host of Podwork Angels, The Rush Hour, a podcast dedicated to the rock band Rush, as well as something that I feature on as well, Noah France. Hello, Noah.
I thought there would be more, too. Just get out. Leave me my podcast.
Yes, that's what Olivia needed, right? It was just a...
A podcast
that would have given her some fulfillment in that moment. If it hasn't been entirely clear what we're referring to yet, I'll get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to introduce our special guest. He is a returning guest, and that is Jeremy Lesser. Hello, Jeremy.
Hey there. Happy to be back.
Yeah, it's been a little while since we've had you on, but we were really happy to have you back on to discuss a movie that is one of your favorites, because this is our flashback series. That is where we invite special guests on to talk about a favorite or maybe their favorite movie in general. So, Jeremy, you have chosen, as we have been kind of alluding to before this point, you have chosen Boyhood, the Richard Linklater film from 2014. This, of course, is a film that chronicled about 12 years in the course of a young boy's life, as well as that of his family, and was actually filmed over the course of 12 years sporadically, and as a result was nominated for several Oscars and actually won one for Patricia Arquette, who played the aforementioned Olivia for Best Supporting Actress. And I wanted to start by asking you, when did you discover this film? And what has it meant to you over the years? And if you would like to talk about Linklater in general, then we would be happy to hear that as well.
Well, I would like to talk about Linklater in general, because he's probably my favorite director and maybe my favorite person that I don't actually know, but I would like to know one day. I've been a Linklater fan for a long time. It started around college time. Maybe a lot of people get into Linklater then. Before movies, Waking Life, that's where I said, this guy's different. I like what he's about. I'd never seen anything like this. You know, started to become aware of the 12-year project, I think as it was called at the time, through like IMDb and researching. And as it got closer and closer, I got so excited. I was like just so pumped for it. And then it ended up with me and Alex and a few other friends actually going into New York the weekend that it premiered at the IFC Theater. And it was such a cool experience. First off, just because like, wow, it was a lot of fun. There was a lot of energy. And, you know, I guess you can fill in any blanks, Alex, on this story, but essentially how I remember it is, we go into the IFC Theater, it's packed, it's a lot of, again, good vibes there, everyone's excited, and I believe
Saturday afternoon,
so not opening night, the next day, and we had heard that Linklater was around, because that IFC Theater is kind of where it all premiered, and thought, maybe he'll be there, but nah, why would he be there at the 1 p.m. or whatever showing on Saturday? But we sit in there, everything's getting going, and Alex turns to me and says, wouldn't it be crazy if Linklater was here or something like that? And all of a sudden, the next thing you know, Linklater and Ellery Coltrane show up in front of us and start giving a little speech. But yeah, if there's anything else there, let me know.
Yeah, no, that was basically it. It was like we were sitting and like if anyone's ever been to the IFC Center, there's like a lot of small theaters and there's one giant auditorium that has like a stage in front of the screen and everything. And we were looking at it and I just like pointed to like the entrance of the stage and I was like, wouldn't it be crazy if Linklater just walked out right now? And like literally the words came out of my mouth and then he walked right out and gave a whole introduction.
It was crazy.
In the introduction, he said, I was supposed to come after this, but I'm double booked, so I can't stay for a Q&A. So instead, I'm just going to introduce with my friend Eller. We're going to talk and do a quick introduction. He does the introduction, and we just like it was as if like my words had manifested a surreal experience. It was very bizarre.
That's fantastic. That's like the time I happened to crush Jennifer Aniston in Berlin.
Did you say, imagine if Jennifer Aniston walked out of that cafe? And then she did.
No, it's just we walked into the Sony Center, which if you've ever been to Berlin, that's like the main like theater part of movie theater place in the city. And there's a red carpet there, and there were a bunch of people gathered around the entrance. And I was like, oh, I wonder what's going on. Oh, there's a poster that has Jennifer Aniston on it. Oh, look, there's Jennifer Aniston right there.
And getting to see it on the big screen with like so many people who were so hyped for it was just like an excellent experience. And I got to watch it with my friend Jeremy and a few of our other friends who all just were very, it was like right after, you know, before Midnight had come out, I think we were all very hyped on Linklater as a director. And also like the context of this film, it was like in many ways felt like it was about our lives over those last 12 years as well. So getting a chance to experience it like that was so special to me, getting to watch it with, you know, people who meant a lot to me during those 12 years.
It was, yeah, it was really a beautiful experience to have that. And the positive news too is that with this movie, while that experience was amazing, it hasn't lost any of its appeal for me. You know, as I go through it, I feel like I probably watched it at this point maybe 6 or 7 times over the years. It's a long movie to watch and sit through, but every time I get something new out of it, and you know, I'll take like breaks and maybe take a year or so apart, but every time I go back to it, I really do, you know, learn more, reflect more, and feel like really get new things out of it. So I'm excited to go into that a bit too, how those experiences have changed. But that initial experience, it's hard to remove that from the movie and its importance to be in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've, at this point, have you seen all of Linklater's other films like leading up to this and beyond, I guess, at this point?
So almost there. To give a little bit of context, back in October, my girlfriend and I randomly decided, what if we just watch a movie every day for as long as we could? And we started that October 1st, and we're still going. To be fair, there has been an inclusion of a couple shorts, so it's not all like feature-length movies, but I'd say like 95% of it is. Honestly, we've made a big commitment on it, and we've been going. And in preparation for this, thought, you know, what if we just went back and watched all the Linklater movies, or as many as we could? We're not all the way up there. There's a couple left, but we've got almost all of them down, including some more obscure short films and his first feature that I never had planned really to watch, but I'm so glad that I did. So in a very, very Linklater mindset these past 2 weeks, for sure.
I'm curious, what about, so Alex, you've talked a little bit how you, you know, discovered this film. It's similar to Jeremy's story, but I know it's one that like has really stuck with you over the years. So I'm curious, like what it's meant to you over the time since you've seen it.
Yeah, it just feels like a film that is an art, like, number one, it just feels like an impossible film, right? Because of the way that it, we'll get into it in more detail, I'm sure, but the way that it was constructed, the way that it was shot for every summer for 12 consecutive years and then comes out. And the protagonist is very close in age to me. He's only about 4 years off from me. So seeing the protagonist's childhood like just splayed out across the screen felt so much like seeing my own, both in the kind of cultural ephemera of the period that we see along the way, but also a lot of kind of specifics about his life are similar to a lot of things that happened in my own life that make the film feel that much more personal and affecting. So it just feels like there's this thing where we talk about how, like, when you see yourself on screen, that it just has a special meaning beyond just, like, the craft of the film. And I think that there's definitely an aspect of it there. But it's also just the fact that it's the sort of movie that Linklater makes that I love that he makes, where it's just people in rooms, taking walks, talking about life instead of just, you know, with all of the kind of, like, subtleties and nuances and maybe not so subtle aspects of it all. And you know, the Before trilogy, as I've said many times in this podcast, is my all-time favorite film trilogy. I think that the what he's able to do with those films and those characters and that collaboration with the actors is just tremendous. And I think this is kind of very much in line with that as well. And so, you know, the anticipation at the time was huge. I watched it 3 times in theaters the year that it came out. I've seen it several times since then. But I put it down about 3 years ago and I said, I'm not going to watch it for a while. I'm going to let it sit so that way I can see how it feels after I've kind of moved past whatever phase of life I'm in and revisit it. And now, you know, I'm past 30 and I watched it again for this podcast, and it certainly hits different in certain ways. And that was an interesting experience to have as well.
What about for you, Noah? What's your experience been with Boyhood?
Simply seeing it because I knew it was one of the big, you know, highlight movies of the year. And it was going to be, at least the hope was that it was going to be a big contender for multiple Oscars. And so I saw it. I don't think I saw it in theaters. I think I had to stream it. It wasn't generally available at that time.
Okay.
but yeah, no, saw it and immediately loved it. It wasn't my number one. I'm pretty sure it was in my top five for that year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's I instantly, you know, knew, okay, I'm seeing something really great. Like, this is an entirely singular filmmaking. Like, okay, yeah, technically you could do another movie like this, but it's such a staggering undertaking. Just the fact that it exists feels like a miracle. And then the fact that it works as a movie feels like another miracle. And then the fact that it doesn't just work, but it's fucking amazing, is like a third. It's like a triple miracle.
I completely agree.
We might get into this, but I really feel like the editing of this movie is like the key to what makes it work. I mean, in addition to many other things, but you know, without that, I'm not quite sure that it would have the staying power that it does.
Only question is, when do we get the director's cut? Boyhood Redux.
That would be interesting.
Don't listen to me, Linklater, if you're listening to this. Don't do a Coppola.
I'm thinking back of my experience with this movie, and I was realizing yesterday, I like had to think to myself, because I have seen all of his feature films, and I feel like I have a pretty good idea of his career. I had to remind myself that when I first saw this back in 2014, I didn't have the relationship with Richard Linklater as a filmmaker that I do today. I mean, he is like one of my, I would say he's like, if not my favorite, if not necessarily my favorite filmmaker, he's definitely one of my most beloved. When I revisit his films, it feels like seeing old friends. And that's what this experience was like for me this time. I saw it, like I said, back in 2014. I had very high expectations. So many of my friends had loved it and recommended it to me, including Alex. I think at the time I saw it, I think maybe I had seen Bernie and The School of Rock. So two of the big Jack Black Linklater movies. And that was about it. I don't think I hadn't seen any of the Before movies. I hadn't even seen Dazed and Confused. Like, I was really missing a lot. And so I saw it and I didn't really like have a grip on what his style was like as a director. And so I was like, wow, this is very low key and like just not a ton of stuff is happening. And we really like moving on from one thing to another. And I think it was a little bit like strange to me just because I didn't quite know what to expect. And it really wasn't until after I had seen it that first time and thought about it, and I actually ended up writing a review for it, where I recognized just how much it had meant to me. And it was my second favorite film of that year. I remember my first was Inherent Vice, but that's because I'm a, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson super
PTA
fan.
Stan.
But it's one that I kept thinking about and was just so impressed by the little things in it. Mm. And we'll get into more of that later, but, I've seen it now. This is the third time that I've seen it in full. And it's just wonderful. Like it just, I mean, I really wanted to try to take diligent notes this time, but I just found myself getting swept up in everything that was happening.
It's just moments, man.
Yeah.
It's the moments.
So many moments. Such wonderful moments, which we'll get into. But yeah, it was great to see it this time. And I was surprised. There were elements especially of things that happened in Mason Jr.'s personal life that I could relate to far more than I could at the time. And that gave it even more of a special resonance for me. It was really great. I'm glad to, like I have with so many of these other flashback movies that we've done, just the chance to revisit something that I know I love, but just feel like my love deepening for it has been very satisfying. So definitely thank you for, you know, giving us a chance to revisit this one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I actually should say I had I actually should say I was familiar. My familiarity with Linklater at the time was School of Rock, but also Waking Life, which quite a while before then had been a deeply personal favorite of mine. Wildly different movie. Completely other opposite end of the football field from where Boyhood is. But just as great and equally deserving of attention. So.
Yeah, for a long time, Waking Life was my number one Linklater film. Even coming into this, I thought, Waking Life, that's my movie. And that also has a lot of personal meaning with friendship and all that, too. That plays into it. But I have to say my ratings have changed. After this watch of Boyhood, it has overlapped Waking Life, because I did watch Waking Life as well recently and still love it. It's a great movie. But as I get older, there's just something about the emotional gut punch of Boyhood that really hits, whereas Waking Life is a lot of fun and it's very interesting and there's many great ideas. It's a great idea, rotoscoping, all that's awesome, but just Boyhood, like you said, the scope of it, the depth of it, there's just nothing else like it.
Well, it is designed to hit you in the feel nads.
Yeah,
but and it's funny works. Yeah, like I agree that it's deeply emotional, but I also love how it doesn't feel like it's aiming for that. It feels like that kind of happens as a result of the conversations and the moments. It's one of those things, like I was just recognizing watching it, just how much of it is about the specifics of a moment and how a moment can change your outlook on life. And it, as it's happening, you might not realize it, but then over the course of these accumulated moments, you start to see transformation. And that's what I think is the big like magic trick of the movie.
Yeah, I totally agree, Justin. I think that the way in which time moves through these people over the 12 years is just really remarkable to see. Obviously, you could tell their story to a certain degree through traditional methods, you know, especially if you weren't dealing with the children. Like if you're just thinking about the Ethan Hawke character or the Patricia Arquette character, you could tell this story over 12 years without needing to have shot it all 12 years. You know, that's kind of the magic of filmmaking, is that it makes it feel like time is passing when it's not. But I think there's a certain authenticity that is captured here that the actors can help bring and that the creative team can bring when you're dealing with these things where your understanding of who your character is going to shift as you age, right? You can, if you were 30 years old when you were cast to be in this movie and let's say you're supposed to start out at 25 and you're supposed to end at 35, you can kind of like work backwards and get a sense of what your take on the character would have been at 25 and then progress to where you are now and then progress into the future, what you think the 35-year-old version of it will be. But that's so different from actually living with a character for 12 years and seeing your relationship to the character change. And I think that's something that's so special about a lot of the two main supporting roles, especially of Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette, is that you really see not only are those characters changing, but it really does feel like those actors are approaching this material in different ways than they would have when the film started, and in different ways as the film progresses. And that's just such an interesting kind of creative project. And there's a lot of ways where that could have gone really wrong and it could have just gotten really derailed. And the fact that it all kind of coheres into a story that feels cogent and compelling is really impressive.
Triple miracle.
You mentioned before, Jeremy, like that, you know, the emotional gut punch of this movie. I'm curious, what is it for you about this movie that has that effect?
Well, you know, it is so much. And I wrote down two scenes, actually, that really stood out to me, that hit me in a way that I was not expecting and that didn't hit me in previous viewings for whatever reason. So just first on the specific side, like there's a scene in the very beginning. I think it's literally the first year where they find out they're going to be moving. And it's kind of last second, and Patricia gets like, get your stuff, let's go, we're all in the car. And, you know, Mason, the character, has this friend. I don't even think the friend has a name. It doesn't matter. You just see that there's that bond. And next thing you know, he doesn't even get a chance to say goodbye. And they're leaving in the car, and the friend is like biking after him and does everything he can just to do this like gentle wave. And I literally lost it. I was like, basically, I was holding back as much as I could, but I was like, we're like 10 minutes into the movie and I'm screwed is what I was thinking, because I was already hit so hard. Thankfully, I didn't like after that, it wasn't too bad. But there was one other scene And it's towards the end at Mason's graduation, between Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke's characters. And just comes up there and is like, "You did a good job. You did a good job." And she's like, "Oh, I never." It's this little moment that I think the first time or first multiple times I saw it, I was like, "Oh yeah, that's nice." And for something this time, as getting into my 30s and seeing the growth of these characters as well, just resonated deeply. You know, my parents are also divorced, and there's something about that. Like, I wish they could have that conversation, but they're not having it. So it was nice to see like a moment like that on screen of, oh, these people can have a connection. But it's bittersweet because I'm also thinking, damn, they could have made this work, you know, like in another universe, like maybe they would have been the right fit. But overall, outside of those specific scenes, you know, it's very similar to what Alex said. Just, you know, the relating, very similar time periods, you know, almost like seeing yourself in a way grow. And I want to bring this up at some point, so I'll bring it up now. But the relation to the Mason character is both push and pull for me. In some ways, I relate very deeply to this character. In other ways, I'm like, I kind of hate you in moments, but I think that's normal in the way that I look back at myself also at like 17. I'm like, oh, you're so cringy. So there's just the beautiful moments like that that really stand out to me. And yeah, like, I don't know, just at the end, that the seeing him go off to the college and the feeling of everything's in front of me, again, the bittersweetness of it as, yeah, it is, but also now getting older, not everything's in front of me. Like, you know, there's obviously still plenty of time and a lot of goals and things I'm moving towards, but same time, there's a slipping away. And I think that's what Linklater does so well, is capture time and capture memory. And that's why I love him as a director. It's just his, I think, in his own words and interviews I've been watching, obsession with time and memory. And this movie is maybe the encapsulation of that.
Yeah, and those sequences, those graduation sequences, you know, the party and afterwards, they carry a unique, it's not just like a standard, you know, graduation party scene that you could get in this kind of movie. Because you've been growing up in you know, very fast forward style with all these people and getting old and, you know, going through time with them and fast forwarding through their lives, it carries a very unique weight. And there is this feeling of all of this time and all these experiences have happened and they're gone now. Like, it's all gone. And now whatever's coming next is going to be something different. So it's like that usual feeling that you have at something like a high school graduation, but just even more potent because you've gone through, you've gone through everything so rapidly. Like, just 2 hours ago, a little over 2 hours ago, you were seeing this kid, you know, at six or seven. Mm-hmm. And now he's graduated high school. And like, that's the feeling, and that simulates the feeling of looking back and feeling like, wait, like, just yesterday I was like five going to kindergarten. Like, what happened? Now I'm graduating high school and I'm older, you know? And it's both the case for young people and then also for the parents. It feels this sense of, holy shit, where did all this time go? You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's something the film does an incredible job. I mean, Mason is obviously the main character. But there's a lot of meat around the, especially, I think his sister's a great character too. But there's a lot of meat around the parents and how they change, the mother especially, but Ethan Hawke also, he gets a lot of moments to, they both get a lot of great moments to really develop these characters as they're growing into them.
Yeah, doubling back to something that Jeremy said before we move on too far, I think that the scene that you spotlight about the Mason's friend kind of chasing after the car, I think that's such an important scene to highlight because that is, in a lot of ways, giving you a preview of what the entire film is. It's like the film in microcosm because it's this really dramatic moment, right? This sort of thing that, like, any other film would be building towards, number one, right? You would have had all this build up to, like, I'm so sad that I'm going to lose my friend and we're going to stay in touch and it's so emotional. And you don't get any of those scenes at all. You just find out that they're leaving and then they get the house ready and then they go. Mm-hmm. And then also, like, it's just such an inherently cinematic thing for a little kid to be chasing after the car with his bike and trying to wave. And Linklater gives us a taste of it and then he cuts. And not only does he cut from the scene, he cuts a year into the future to the point where, like, Mason doesn't even remember that kid anymore, probably. Like, and that's giving us everything we need to know about what this film is going to be moving forward. And I think so many of the scenes that they choose to highlight give us that feeling. And the way that time moves, it's always so abrupt and it's always so striking, where you all like sometimes, and especially in those middle years, you're like, are we in a new time period? Are we not in a new time period yet? And then other times you're just like, oh my God, he's like a whole new person after this year passed. And that's so specific to what it's like to watch, to number one, to grow up, but much more so to watch a kid grow up, where it's like they're in that same time period for a certain amount of time, and then in the blink of an eye, they're all of a sudden so much older than you realized they were. And watching it now, having had, you know, a decade of being working with kids and of having nieces and nephews myself, and, you know, my oldest niece was born when I was in college, and now she has her first boyfriend, and it's just like, how did this happen? Like, you know, like time just really moves so much faster than you think it does, and it moves faster when you can watch it on someone else than when you're experiencing it. And I think this film captures both of those things so well. It captures the Mason character as he's slowly progressing through time in this rapid way, but it's also capturing, like, for the parents, what it's like to see a kid's life just go from 0 to 60 so quickly, and know what that means for the amount of time that they've spent in their lives as well. And it's just, it really hit me, that aspect of things really hit me much harder this time around, because it's not as much about, man, when you look back, like, a lot of things happened in 12 years. It's now, it's like, wow, 12 years happened so fast. I can't, like, what about, will the next 12 years be even faster, you know? And, like, that's where the kind of...
Spoiler, yes.
Yeah. It's tough. And this movie captures that, like, in a way that's really powerful.
Yeah,
and congratulations, Mason, you're starting college in like 5 minutes. It's going to be done.
I want to say one more thing, I promise, about the scene of his friends and that, because it was fascinating to me to watch it this time, because my memory of that scene was different than how it actually plays. My memory of the scene was of his friend chasing him, and then, like, we still see him in the frame, and then it cuts, like you said, Alex, to like a year later. What actually happens is, his friend's chasing him, and before it cuts from that shot, his friend disappears behind some tall grass. And what I thought was interesting about, so I didn't remember that. I just remembered going, you know, just cutting, and it's almost like even in that moment, he's being lost. So even before we cut ahead to this other time where he's not a part of his life anymore, he's lost him. And like that little thing, because he could have just cut and had him in the frame and had him like a lingering memory. But even in that moment, it's like you're feeling the loss of it, even as it isn't entirely gone. And I just love that. That's just a purely visual thing that really resonated with me this time. And I think it's reflective of more largely what the film is doing. It's not just about the relentlessness of time, but of change. That's the other big thing for me. And I think that really hit me on a personal level, because when it happens here, it's abrupt, it's sudden, it's uncomfortable. You feel like you've just gotten your moorings and then you're on to the next thing, and it never stops. And that's a big part of life. And even at age 32, I'm still finding trouble accepting that. So to see it play out cinematically and just for people to just disappear from the story completely, which is something I think Linklater has done in some other movies before, just not quite in this way, is really just, it's jarring. It's almost disturbing in the way that happens, but it's a fact of life. When someone can be so close to you or feel like such a part of your life and then just not be a part of it at all. And you have to figure out, who am I now? Like, who are my people? And where do we go from here? And this film just captures that so beautifully.
Yeah. And also it makes the moments where people who you thought were lost come back that much more potent. Like at that graduation party, when like that family that took them in when she's running from the abusive husband, like, and then they've been gone for so long, and then you see them there at the graduation party, like, that means so much. It means as much to me probably as it does to the family that are there having the party for themselves, right? Because you're just like, oh man, like, I thought you were gone forever from these people's lives, but it meant enough to you that you're getting to share this moment with them. Like, that's so special. And then you think about all the people who weren't part of that. Like, their step siblings are just gone and they're never.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about them.
That's the part of the movie that hit me so hard on this rewatch.
Yeah. It's really brutal.
First off, just the filmmaking of, you know, finding the mother in the garage and then the dinner scene and then the scene where she pulls him out of the house. That is just harrowing filmmaking. That's mimicking real life. You're doing something else. Your mind is somewhere else. You're thinking about school or work or whatever. And you just walk into a fucking horror movie, you know, something in some tragedy, either directly in your life or even if you're just witnessing it from someone else, like, will suddenly just appear before you, you know, and it's like you flip from a comedy to a horror movie suddenly. Like, that's what life is at times like that. And it's so cuttingly effective. And it's like anyone who tries, and there have been people who've done this, anyone who dunks on this movie as being like, oh, it's only special because of the gimmick and there's no like actual good filmmaking there. Like, no.
Yeah.
Watch the movie.
Well, and I've heard people complain actually about that middle sequence as like, well, they're like injecting too much drama and it becomes so over the top and it doesn't really align with the beginning and the end of the film.
Alcoholics are over the top. That's what alcoholism is.
Yeah, I never once had that thought.
No, because I never did either, because it's like, I mean, unfortunately, I have to say that I've had experiences like that in my own family with these sorts of situations. And it's like, that is what it feels like. And that is what it's like. And I think that
Smoothly transition in and out of it. It's there and then maybe it's not. No,
and sometimes it feels, and especially when you're the age that Mason is in that sequence, it does feel so larger than life because it's the most extreme thing that you've ever experienced and you're old enough to know that it's not supposed to be happening, right? When you're a kid, if you experience something that's that extreme, it still is somewhat normalized because that's just all you know. But by the time you're like 12, 13 years old, you know that this isn't supposed to be happening, but you also know that it is happening. And it hits you in a way that it won't in any other part of your life, I don't think.
And it's like, maybe there were signs of it before, but as a child, even as an somewhat older child, your brain can kind of filter out small things, but then something will happen that just shoves it in your face and your brain can't like just chuck it to the back room anymore, you know, and you're just confronted with it in that moment.
I think that this also goes towards the structure of the film. And this is something that came out to me a lot in this viewing, is that the perspective of the film shifts in three discrete times. At the first opening section of the film, it's you're seeing the parents from the kid's perspective, right? The kid, like Mason, is not really the main character. So you do have some scenes alone with him, but really it's you're looking at his mom and you're looking at his dad through his eyes. And then in the middle section of the movie, he is becoming more of his own person, but he is completely weighed down by his parents' choices, right? He has no power, but he has awareness of the full effects of what's going on. And so he is being forced to deal with the burdens of his parents' choices. And then in the final section of the film, he's actually getting a chance to make his own choices and decide who he is going to be. And he's just starting that journey, but it's just so interesting to see that as a progression over time. And that really does mirror, I think, at least my own like experience of growing up, where you really do feel like you were just kind of like, when you're a kid, you're just seeing your parents and you're seeing the world like through the adults around you. And then at a certain point, you're old enough and aware enough to know like what's going on, but completely powerless to do anything about it. And then you move into a place where if you're lucky, you get a chance to make some choices for yourself and you have to decide, well, what do I want to be? And how can I synthesize all of the experiences that I've had to do something different than what has done before, or to follow in the footsteps of the people who I respect, you know, regardless. Yeah,
that's how growing up progression
is really powerful in this rewatch of the film for me.
And that's how it should be. You know, that should be the process of growing up. You bit by bit, you know, you become more capable and more able and you're given more permission to be your own, to define yourself as a person. Doesn't always happen, but
and that's why I love the scene at the end with Mason Jr. and Mason Sr. And after Mason's graduation, he goes to Austin with his dad, and is like, what's the point of anything, or what does it all mean? And that's like, I don't know. And there's just this beautiful, like, hey, I don't know about anyone here, but I've had those moments with my parents where you switch from, oh, like, guide me, help me, tell me what to do, to, oh, you're just as confused as I am. Like, you're also a person who's flawed and doesn't know. And in a way, that's sad. And in a way, it's beautiful.
You know, talking about that now, it kind of reminds me of one of the earlier scenes where it's kind of more towards the middle of the movie where they're visiting their dad, and he's 11, 12, somewhere around, definitely preteen. And they're lying on the couch trying to fall asleep, and he just asks his dad, like, does magic exist? Do elves exist?
Yeah.
It's got that great line. So sweet. No, technically, no elves.
That's anybody who's ever, like, had a relationship with a kid can recognize that completely, because you're just like, he was so proud of himself that he came up with this whole metaphor to, like, keep the magic of the world alive, and the kid doesn't care at all about that. He just literally wants to know, do elves exist or not?
Like, yeah, technically, it might be the best one-liner of the movie. Technically, no elves.
Oh gosh.
But it's kind of like, that's a more childish version of that, you know, the kid going to the parent and trying to, like, asking for guidance about something that's bothering them. And then, of course, the much more adult version of that is, what's the point of life? Like, that's on par with, you know, does God exist? Does the soul exist? Is there life after death? You know, what's the meaning of it all? You know, that's the more adult version. And the kid version is, you know, is Hogwarts real? Do elves exist? You know?
And I think that is such an accurate, like, comparison to bring up, because my feeling watching that scene with Mason Sr. and Mason Jr. in Austin at the end of the film is that if Mason Jr. asked Mason Sr. this question at the start of the film, he would have come up with an entire long, rambling explanation for the meaning of life, would have felt really proud of himself, and it would have been complete bullshit. And here, he's progressed to the point where he, like, has actual tangible advice to give him earlier in that scene about, like, self-esteem and about girls and stuff. But the big things, he's mature enough to know, like, I'm secure enough in myself to say, I don't know what the hell, why we're here. I don't know that answer. Mm. And that's okay that I don't know that answer. And it's okay that you don't know that answer either. And in answering that way, that actually is so much more valuable than what Mason Sr. would have done 12 years earlier ever could have been.
Yeah, no, you see the parent, like, the parents grow with their kids. And, like, again, ideally, that's how it should be, you know. The kids, you grow up with your kids as well, and that experience just changes you as a parent.
Yeah, and I think it's especially interesting when you compare the way that he talks with his parents to other adult figures, especially authority figures. And sometimes that's the form of a step-parent, sometimes it's the form of a teacher. I think there's a lot
of... The restaurant boss at the end just kills me.
Oh, so good.
I believe in you, Mason. I've got you down for Fry Chef. That sounds fucking terrible, man. I've been there.
That character is so earnest. Like, he means it.
He's actually invested in him as a person.
He's adorable. He's cute.
And maybe even in a way that we're not even sure if Mason really deserves, because it doesn't seem like his. You know. But
mother? Oh, wow.
What I was going to say is, one of the things I really noticed on this viewing was the way that he especially deals with adversity from those figures. He has this kind of, like, it comes off, I think, like this passive detachment, but it's almost like he's sort of conditioned in a way to, like, that's going to be the response that creates the least provocation. And I just thought that was really fascinating, because you can tell he's repressing a lot. And it comes out, I think, in some of those monologues later on in the film, which aren't even related to any of that stuff, but just about his general feelings on the world. And I just thought that was interesting. I think one of the things this film does so well, and one of the criticisms it's gotten, is that it's not like, well, this isn't like a proper reflection of, like, what childhood is like at large. And I'm kind of like, does it need to be? It's about this specific person, and it gets into all those specifics so well. Like, why isn't that enough to celebrate? So I don't know. It tells this one story so well that to me is maybe more important. I like that it did that, as opposed to try to make this universal statement about childhood. And maybe that's reflected in that conversation he has with Mason Sr., that there isn't this larger point that needs to be made.
Yeah, and I think also it's like he's an interesting main character to follow because he is so passive in so many situations, but I do feel like he most of the time is internalizing it all. He can't really kind of in the moment be as present as I think anyone around him wants him to be, but he does seem to really take it all in, and it really it's created this very idiosyncratic person at the end of the day. And I think that that really says something about the a person who really is taking in all of the experiences that they have, right? Like there were a lot of different paths that he could have ended up on, and the path that he went on is very specific, and it feels very informed in the way that real life would present it, right? It's not this direct like my mom really like tried to go to school but didn't follow her passion, so I'm gonna follow my passion. Like, no, it's not interested in doing that. But what it is doing is saying like, oh, my mom worked really hard and tried to do all of the things right, and it didn't seem to work out well for her. I'm gonna try to do something different with my life. And like, who knows what his life is ultimately gonna be, but that's clearly where he's at 17, 18. And I think that makes sense if that's what you grew up in, right?
Gotta say, I like the fact that the camera thing, like, that's introduced as an aside. That's like two sentences in a conversation about other stuff. And then it's a while later that we're like, oh, that's developed into a passion. Because that's how that usually starts. It's not a grand introduction to something. It's someone suggests an activity, you try something out, and then eventually, a couple of years later, it becomes a hobby. And then maybe it goes from there into a passion or a professional ambition.
Yeah, and I think that's very specific to like Richard Linklater's relationship with art and creating art as a filmmaker as well. When you hear him talk about it, it's like he was not particularly passionate about being a filmmaker from a young age. He was interested in a lot of different things, and he kind of was like a go with the flow kind of person, and he was able to socialize and try a lot of different things out as a result. And somehow he ended up being a filmmaker, and thank God, because he's made some of my favorite films ever. So I'm so grateful for that. But he certainly didn't have a moment where someone sat him down with a camera and said, this is going to be your future. And he said, oh my goodness. And then devoted his life to it. That's not his experience at all. So it makes sense that Mason's wouldn't be either.
Gotta say, I also want to give some love to the sister, to Sam. I think the way that her relationship plays a role and how they often build each other up. I found really sweet and really compelling to follow along as well. I feel like she's been getting lost in the shuffle a bit because we've been talking about the parents so much.
Yeah. Well, and that's Lorelai Linklater. That's Richard Linklater's daughter. She's not really an actress outside of this film. And if you listen to interviews that he did while making the film, he said basically that like when she was little, like she just wasn't gonna let me not put her in this movie, so I did. And that at a certain point she wanted to be killed off of the film because she hated doing it so much. But it seems like she ended up in a nice place by the end of it as well. So like kind of mirroring that kind of finding respect for your parents over time. But I'm not surprised to see that she hasn't done anything really since then, but it makes her be a very interesting presence in the film.
No, it makes it a very real presence because she's just being herself, you know? And I mean, that kind of feeds into her character, being like, especially if she had a point where she's like, come on, Dad, I don't want to be in the film. Because she has this whole period of time in the movie where her character's like, oh, come on, man.
Yeah, which is very, like, accurate to how a lot of teenagers are. Yes. During that period of their life. So it really, like, they use it all in a way that works really well.
Exactly. And it's just, I mean, I love the dynamic between all the four core members of this family. I just think they're all kind of adorable. And by the end, I just want to give all of them a big hug.
They all could use it.
Yeah, they
That's
definitely
true.
Could.
Yeah.
They're all, they're all more or less in like a good place too, or at least a safe place, you know?
I don't know. I think Olivia is not in a good place. I think she could be in a good place, but I don't think she is right now.
She's not in an actively abusive relationship that endangers her safety. Like, she's got the time and space. Like, she could theoretically work through these issues in peace.
She could.
And not have glasses.
Not right now.
I always forget that the last time we see her, she is distraught.
Yeah.
You know, I'd forgotten, actually, that's the last moment we have with her. And you know, and something about that moment, because that's like her that's like the scene that won her the Oscar, basically. It was that moment of the film. Like that's like her money making scene.
You don't think it was the scene where the manager at the restaurant comes over to her and says, "Thank you for changing my life and encouraging me to learn English."
Well, can we all agree that's the worst scene in the movie, or no?
Yeah,
I love it on like a sweet level, but my God, does that feel unrealistic for a movie that feels very realistic outside of that?
Well,
scene.
Okay, like
maybe I'm a cynic.
It's an important moment for her character, but it's not like it's not as far as her performances. It's not the scene that people go to as like, oh, here's an example of why this was such a great performance. Like, I'm not saying that she's not doing a great job in that scene as well, but it's more subtle.
She's like, acting very, it's actually, she's making a lot of interesting choices in that scene because like she's in the middle of yelling at her kids for like mooching off of her. And then this guy comes out of nowhere who she might not even remember. And the way that she plays it, it's really not clear if she does, and pays her this like unreal compliment. And she just doesn't really know how to process it. And so I think it is a good acting scene from her, but it is not a good scene in the script.
it's not a flashy scene. Like her, the scene with Mason at the end, you know, go and leave my, that's the flash.
Well, that's literally what they played as her Oscar clip.
That's what I'm saying. Like that's what I'm talking about. Like, you know, the money, like money shots or money scenes or stuff like that, you know, like the big flashy ones that people talk about and remember, you know, it comes and, you know, and again, we're talking about ways in which this movie just to an uncanny degree feels so much less like a movie and feels like you're seeing a snippet of someone's real life. It's just, it is an offhand comment from Mason. He's not thinking anything by it. He's not trying to start, but just, and she's not even expecting it. It's just what he says and the way he says it just suddenly hurls her into this deep existential crisis. And that's set up with, he says that line, and then the camera immediately cuts to like a wide shot of the room, and you just see her sitting in absolute silence for like 5 seconds.
It's like another. There's like a little insert shot before her breakdown.
Exactly. He says it. There's like a 5 second interlude where like it hits her ears and goes into her brain, and then the spiral begins, and then he comes in and like the
well, and it's just a perfect mother son scene, because it's like, you know, like Mason seems like a genuinely like emotionally intelligent person at this point in the film, if a little self-involved. Yeah. And so, well, and he does seem to genuinely respect and care about his mom. There's no real animosity there. So it feels like if he had noticed the way that what he was saying was affecting her, he would have changed his course and been a little bit more sensitive. But he's just so focused on, I'm moving out of my, like, I'm getting packed up, I'm ready to go. He's so in his own head and in his own perspective that he can't see how hard this is for her. Because you'll notice that, like, she's trying to get this little bit of sentimental value out of it for her, really for her, but she's projecting that to him. And if he had noticed it then, it could have actually been a really special moment between the two of them. But instead, it becomes a terrible moment between the two of them because he can't see what she's going through in that moment, and she can't articulate it because she doesn't have the words. And so it just becomes rage, and then it just ruins everything. And that's so real.
We don't get that moment of resolve. We don't get that resolution. Like, the scene ends there with, like, I thought there'd be more. End scene. We don't get a reconciliation, at least not that we see, but, and that's also very appropriate because, you know, how do you respond to that? How do you fix that moment?
Yeah. I have to say, I'm a little bit with the kids in the fact that she's not even getting a second bedroom in her condo. I feel like you got two kids. You should have at least a spare bedroom. It's going to be like, that will make holidays hard. They're both going to sleep on the couch. That sucks.
Yeah.
Well, I think that does tie in with, we do get a sense in the mother kind of having a tendency to jump from one extreme to the next. I think it's very fascinating that her like area of study and work and interest ends up being psychology, when you can tell immediately there's all sorts of psychological like meat to dig into.
Well, with all the right choices. I mean,
well, no, like she clearly I find it fascinating because she clearly has a number of, you know, emotional and psychological issues. You know, there's it. That's also very realistic that people will will end up in a series of relationships that have the same type of problems.
And but the thing about this movie that I think is really smart is that it shows that, like, she didn't sign up to be in a relationship with three emotionally distant and somewhat abusive people. She was with one person who was very immature and not dependable. So then she moved on. She said, I learned my lesson. I'm going to go with someone who has their life together. They're established. They're mature. They're dependable. They're responsible. They're all, and so she goes with her college professor. Then turns out he's a terrible, insecure alcoholic. Not great. Couldn't have known that at the time. Although when we're watching it, especially when you watch it a second time around, everything that's bad about that man is in that scene, and everything that you that she sees that's good about him is in that scene too. And you really can only notice it in hindsight. And I think that makes that meeting scene so interesting. But then you move on, right? So she moves out of that situation. She gets herself free. She goes to this new person who is kind and considerate and totally like altruistic and trying to better himself actively, right? Totally opposite from what she was just with. What does it end up being? The same situation, right? Not nearly as abusive, thankfully, but the red flags are flying and she gets out of there. So she learned her lesson enough to not stay, right? But like she couldn't have anticipated that when all of the things that made that person feel so good about himself was taken away by circumstance, that he would fall into some of the similar traps that the person she had just been with was. So I feel like real life, right? We move from person to person trying to correct our mistakes, but we're not omniscient. We don't know what the future is going to hold. And so we end up in similar situations over and over again because we can only solve the last problem, right? We're fighting the last battle. We're not seeing the person that we're looking at clearly because we're just focusing on what they are, that they're not the person that we were just with.
We don't get any specifics. Is it implied that Jim like lost his job and or is never able to even find a job after graduating?
It's after it's implied that he graduates and then he can't get a job, so he has to work at a prison, and that is like terrible, and that's like all of the worst, and he gets that because of his military experience.
He has that corrections jacket, so he's
trying to leave that world by going to college, and then there was no jobs, and so he falls back into the world that he was trying to get out of, and it made him depressed.
Yeah,
I do want to say though, just to agree with Noah a little bit on the issues there, the irony of someone who is involved in psychology teaching it and has horrific boundaries when it comes to relationships. I mean,
yes, well,
dating
yeah,
the
that's
professor,
true.
Dating the student, these are pretty big red flags. So I definitely agree on that side of, maybe don't do this. You know, as someone and myself, I do work in the mental health field. So it's kind of like, this is some pretty basic stuff here. We don't date our students. We don't date our clients. So nonetheless, I get that this is real life and these things still happen. But I do think there's something there of, okay, there's some bad boundaries. And you know, it makes sense in the context of the character, but those bad boundaries affect everything.
Yes. Yeah. And you see that even in her relationship with her kids and with her first husband too. Like that scene at the graduation that you mentioned earlier, the thing that I love about that scene is that it's not the scene that I think any other movie like this would have given, where the two parents sit down and they say, man, we did such a great job raising those kids together, and it's so great that we can have this like good relationship now. Like the past was crazy, but we've grown so much and we can really see each other for who we are now. That's not what happens in that scene. Like Ethan Hawke tries to do something nice, right? Kind of fumbles it, but he gets the words out enough. But Patricia Arquette's guard is up the entire time. She's like surprised to get a compliment, but is waiting for the other shoe to drop. So isn't really taking it in. And then when she finally lets herself take it in a little bit by being like, sure, you can give me the money, I guess that would be nice. Mm-hmm. Then he doesn't have the money. And it's like, and she's like, see, he's the same fuck up that he always has been. Right. And that's like, that's real life, right? This character is not letting go of what happened between them 20 years earlier. She's just not. And it makes sense that she wouldn't, because it's like, if that had worked out, maybe none of the other terrible shit that happened to her would have happened, right? That's clearly how she's processing it. And that's definitely not the most healthy way to process it, but it's very realistic, I think.
No, it's interesting that they, you know, with the character, they give him space to make him very likable. And yet, when you think about the details of it, where was he? He just disappeared to Alaska for years. Like, it's not super clear, but that's a pretty bad dad move. Like, that's not a good father to do that. And yet, I still can't help but think, man, I kind of wish he was my dad in some ways, at least in some of these scenes.
I think we all wish Ethan Hawke to be our dad.
I would definitely take that off for sure. But yeah. Even in this character, I still find myself like him, even when he doesn't have the money to give there, or even when he's away in Alaska doing whatever, there is a sympathy I have for the character. And I think that's a testament to Linklater and to Ethan Hawke, but there's something real about that too. You know, there are people in life who are kind of, you know, maybe not reliable, and yet you still have the heart in them, and you still
feel for them. Yeah, they're charming, or they do intend to do the good thing. They just drop the ball constantly.
Yeah, and it lets you see why his kids would have such affection for him and would really have a good, solid relationship, because as they became more aware of the world, he became better and better at being a parent. But Patricia Arquette's character had the most exposure to him when he was the worst parent, right? Mm-hmm. So she's just not going to let that go. And the movie lets both be true, and it lets all of these relationships exist independent of each other and in conversation with each other. And that's just not common in a film.
Mm. Yeah, when you have both, like, it's clear, okay, it didn't work out between them. Probably would not have worked out for a number of reasons. But they're both, and they can be fundamentally decent people, but still clearly great on each other in ways where you're like, yeah, it makes sense that it didn't work between them.
Yeah,
you know?
There must have been such a strong temptation to give them a very happy resolution between their two characters in that scene. And I just really respect the fact that they make it a little bit more complicated.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm so like glad they didn't go down that road. You can't completely undo certain hurts. You know, you just have to live with them. Be like, well, it happened, and here we are.
I wanted to give everyone a chance to maybe talk about a favorite moment, whether it's an acting moment, whether it's just a great little scene. You know, we've talked about a few of them already, but I'm curious what's been, you know, what really resonates with you. What's a moment that really hits you? It could be on an emotional level, or just, you know, maybe is really funny or is really dark.
Go ahead. The one that comes to me that I wrote down, I was like, I have to bring this up. It's more on the funny side, but it's when the boys they're gathered together. He's probably a teenager at this point, and it's like the guys who are a couple years older, and then the younger kids, and they're drinking beers and in this abandoned place, and they're throwing Death Stars. And the first time I saw this, I was so anxious. I was like, is this where this movie's going? Someone's losing an arm. Someone's losing an eye. I don't want this in my story at all. And then afterwards, you know, the sigh of relief of nothing happens. And I go, well, man, how many times have I been in a similar situation where you don't even realize that you're putting yourself in extreme danger? And it's all fun and laughs. And maybe 90% of the time you get out of it, you're totally fine. But, you know, in retrospect, as an adult now, I'm like, oh my God, how did I let myself in this position? And even right now, when I watched it again, I was like very anxious that I was in this scene, even though I knew it was going to be fine. And there's something about that felt so true to like teenage life. And I just had to bring that one up.
And he seems to be like, Linklater seems to be setting up that scene where something bad's going to happen right as the scene ends. Like there's that one moment, like they've thrown, you know, the saw blades into the wall, but then they're going to have like the one kid who they've really been dunking on the most hold this wooden board so that the one kid can punch it. And you think like, oh, this is where it happens. And then he just punches it and it's fine. And then they cut to the next scene. Yeah. It's like he's almost deliberately setting it up so that you think something bad's going to happen just to show that doesn't usually, you know, that doesn't always happen in life. Sometimes you're in a dangerous situation and things work out. And this is just an example of that.
Well, and it is true that, like, when you watch the scene a second time, like, it's clear that you're experiencing it through, like, Mason's perspective and through these kids' perspective, and they genuinely don't think they're doing anything dangerous. Like, there's, like, a certain kind of, like, oh, this is, like, we're, like, a little naughty kind of, like, we're grown-ups, we don't need to follow the rules, right? But they don't think that they're at all in danger, like, actual danger, because if they were, they would be acting very differently. And it's, like, and ultimately they're not in danger, right? But they were in danger and just nothing bad happens. But yeah, Jeremy's right. I mean, we knew each other back then, and you know, I wouldn't have been in a place like that, but that was because I was a big worry.
But I would have, at least for some period of time. So that's why it hit me hard. I was like, I've not been in this exact situation, but I've been in way too many looking back. I'm like, I am lucky to be alive. Yeah. Very lucky.
And just like the way that they're all talking about like having sex, and clearly none of them have ever touched a woman before. It's just like very funny.
Speaking of dangerous situations, I think one moment that really stood out to me on this watch was the scene where Bill, the actor, the character played by Marco Perella, who's the second husband, the abusive alcoholic, is checking their phones. That whole scene.
Oh my God.
That goes on so long. He checks every single phone.
That's parade of red flags.
The last like tete-a-tete with Sam, trying to figure out if she's actually talked to the mother, and like I've seen this twice before, and I'm like, I don't remember what happens here. Like, he could snap at any moment, and just like his intensity, the way he looks at her, the way he like lowers his face a little bit as he looks at her and like gives her this glare. I just think I really like the performance a lot, even as the character is like completely terrifying to me. I was watching a lot of that whole scene with that character and just being like thinking in my head, I am so grateful I never had this experience in my life, because this is like the worst thing I could possibly.
And just the way that like even in that moment, where he's so consumed with like anxiety and dread and is projecting it through this like sheer like terror and intimidation of these kids, he still manages to inject shame into it by highlighting the fact that the one daughter, his daughter, who he clearly thinks is the most responsible, right? Mm-hmm. He trusts her. He makes a point to say, I trust you. I don't need to see your phone. Just to make everyone else in the room feel that much worse, because he just can, it's pathological the way that he belittles these kids just to make himself feel a little bit better in these situations. And that, I mean, very triggering, very reminiscent of things in my past, unfortunately. And just, very, very difficult section of the film to watch. And but it's so like it builds over time so well, right? Like the way that you first see him favoring Mason by putting down his own son over and over again. And Mason kind of liking it a little bit, like not like in a point where like I think Mason would rather him not be mean to the other kid. But it's nice for Mason to have this kind of positive male figure and get this attention. And over time, you see how that just turns, because it was never about Mason. It was about making his son feel bad. And as soon as Mason stops being this like new like object to use against everyone else, like the venom gets twisted and sent his way. And it's so disgusting.
Yeah. What about for you, Noah?
We just had such a heavy moment.
Well, I can go if you want to think about a little
bit. Something positive.
Yeah, so for me, a moment that really stands out to me is, so in when Mason is a junior in high school, right, he has this like incredible like night out in Austin with his girlfriend where they're just like imagining what their future will be like, and it feels like it's right out of like an indie movie from that period, and you're just like, wow, this just, it all feels so magical, this could be our life, right? And then you cut to like the next sequence and it's like, oh, they broke up. And it's like really messy, and actually they kind of hate each other, and they don't even realize how much they hate each other yet, but they're slowly beginning to realize the further away they get from each other. And it just is like the contrast between like the scene of them on the roof, right, where it's just like magic, like pure romance magic, to the scene of them on the bleachers, which is just like small and petty and annoying, not even like traumatic, just annoying. From both of their perspectives, it's just perfect, because it's like, yeah, that's how fast, especially when you're young, that's how fast that can change. And it just is, it's just, you know, we lose so much of their relationship, but I think it's worth it because what you get is so impactful, that contrast.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing this up, because this was my other one that I wanted to mention, is that contrast, because it just, it does stick with you and it feels so real to life. And you know, again, just those feelings of, oh, it's all in front of us and we can do it. And then life hits you in the face. It goes, no, it's not. It's not for you two, not together. And yeah. And it's interesting, too, how Mason Sr. comes back later. Ethan Oxgarden is just like, yeah, I never really liked her. Kind of sucked. and, you know, who knows what was really true or not in that. Maybe right. He's being supportive, but. At the same time, I could kind of see that too. Like, even in the first interactions, there's an attraction, but I'm also like, I don't know if you guys are really the best fit or anything. And you can only kind of see that, you know, I think with more experience and perspective, but that is how it works when you're 16, 17. You know, there's some kind of intrigue, and next thing you know, you're dating, and next thing you know, you hate each other. It's just very real. Unfortunately.
And what's great about it is that they don't sell any of that out, right? There's not a point in their actual relationship, especially that sequence, and where there's like this hindsight being infused into it, where it's like this, like, oh man, they don't see it now, but they're not a good fit for each other, right? It's not, they're fully in the moment of this like beautiful romantic thing, and then they're not, and both things are true. The seeds of their falling out are there from the start. Like Jeremy says, you could see it that they're not a great long-term fit, but that moment that they have together in Austin is real and it's beautiful, and nothing can take that away from them even after things have soured. And I just think that it's really important to remember both of those things when you look back on, you know, past romances that you've had, right? Like, sometimes the things that are beautiful really were beautiful, and then the things that were really terrible, and that's just life, you know? One doesn't need to negate the other.
And Linklater really does, like, you kind of have to play catch-up a little bit to figure out that's what's happened, because he doesn't just cut from them on the roof to them on the bleachers. It's him, like, pulling down the pictures on the, I don't even know what to call that, like, not walls, but the, like...
It was a display.
Display stands.
And then you have to figure out, like, what exactly, like, you get little hints of why, like, there were, like, little triggers. And I actually got confused watching it this time. I had to read a little summary to figure out, like, oh, no, it's one person that she cheated on him with, not two. I thought there was someone at the school in addition to at the college. And I was like, this is so convoluted. But, yeah, no, it's... There's a lot there, and there's a lot of like little things, like you can tell that they're kind of like still, you know, there's the thing that she says about like, well, we both knew this was going to happen. And I think at that point you have to understand, I believe they've both been accepted to different colleges, right? Because they talked earlier about going to UT Austin, and we learned later that he's gone to somewhere else. But I like that he lets you play catch up so that it's like you're in that same kind of headspace of like, I can't believe this is actually happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's always, from my perspective, that's always the better approach. I'd rather you drop me into a moment and let me figure out what's happening than to put me in a moment and have the people in the moment very inorganically tell me what's going on. It's like, well, as you know, you walked in on me sleeping with the lacrosse guy 2 weeks ago, and I was so angry.
The weather was drizzly.
That's what's so great about his dialogue in this movie, is that it's you do get exposition, you do get little explanations, but not enough where it ever feels inorganic. It feels like he's giving you enough to give you information, but in a way that doesn't feel like it's giving away everything, and it's still feeling so like something these characters would say, which is that's a really hard thing to do. I'm sure the actors had a part in that as well.
From a screenwriting perspective, from a writing perspective, that balancing act is so hard to do.
Yeah.
It's easy to just do an exposition dump.
Before, Noah, you give your last moment, there's just one other small moment that's like an honorable mention moment for me. And that's when, in that scene in Austin with Mason Jr. and Mason Sr., when they're at the rock show or like the pre-show, and his friend, who I think is named Jimmy, just like notices that Mason is up there and just like has this moment where he's like, oh my god, like, I can't believe how old you are. I don't know why. I mean, I think I do know why, but that like made me cry when I watched it this time around, because it's like, yeah, because from that guy's perspective, he saw him probably all the time when he was like 9, 10, 11 years old. then probably didn't see him at all for years and years and years, but was close with the dad still, like in the way that adults are close, where they probably talked a few times a year and maybe saw each other once every 2 years. And now suddenly he doesn't think much time has passed at all, but he's like a full grown person. And he's just like, what? And they underplay it, but that actor does such a great job of like letting him have a little bit of an emotional moment that's like very understated before kind of just like finishing the scene. And I don't know, I thought it was very beautiful.
No, it definitely stood out to me too. I'm glad you mentioned that moment.
All right, I'm gonna be typical. I'm gonna go with the very final scene, because I think it hit me in the feels, because you know it brought me back to my college days and you know the sense of openness and adventure that there was there. And it also, it does a great job of feeling like a natural conversation, but still being able to really effectively sum up the cumulative effect of the movie that we've been given up to that point. Like, it serves as an excellent thematic summation of kind of the point of the movie, in as much as there is a single point to be made. And then also, you know, it's an engaging scene because it is charged with that electricity of, you know, kind of like a meet cute. You're just meeting someone new, and maybe both of you are thinking along the lines of, oh, maybe this could be something. But you don't quite want, you can tell that they're thinking that, but they don't quite want to say it. And it ends on this moment of like, she looks at him and then looks away. He looks at her, looks away. And then they look at each other. And that's when the movie ends. That's when it cuts to the credits.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's as perfect an ending that as the movie could have possibly had. Like, I could not imagine anyway.
Something that I like about that scene is that, and that whole sequence once he's at college, is that it just so perfectly captured what it was like to like start college, where you're just like, oh, here are new people, my roommate, they're friends, these all seem really cool, we're gonna be friends for all of college probably, I can't wait. And then it's like, you know that probably 2 weeks from now, like, he probably hates his roommate, he never talks to he hooked up with that girl once and is never gonna see her again, and he's gonna have a whole different social life after that moment. But in this moment, it's like, this is the possibility of the future, this is gonna be my whole life. And it's like, it's not any more your whole life than any of the other moments that have come beforehand. It's all your life and none of it is your life. And that's like a great place to end the film.
I mean, Justin, as you and I can confirm, it's the people you meet on day two that matter. Day one, fuck it. You can throw it in the garbage bin.
That's right.
It's day two.
I saw you on day one because we had gone to the same, what do you call it? Like coffee
freshman
house
mixer
meeting. Yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Orientation mixer? No. It was
Wasn't it the ink coffee
house? Yeah, yeah. It was like a where people would like read their work.
It was a poetry slam.
Kind of, yeah.
On the first day of college?
This was not the first day of classes. This was the first day of where we had moved in.
The weekend of freshman orientation
week. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
bold to start out orientation with a poetry slam.
Well, no, there was a series of events, and it was like, here are the different things you could go do tonight on campus. So it's,
I would not have been vulnerable enough to, or secure enough to read poetry the first day of college.
I didn't read any poetry.
I read a poem that I, looking back on it, I'm like, I would not have read that now.
Roses are red, violets are blue, college is cool, so are you.
It was about a Stevie Ray Vaughan guitar solo. Yep, that's the kind of guy I am.
Very cool.
There's nothing wrong with that. It could have been a lot worse.
That wasn't the issue as much as some things in it, which I think were unintended. Anyway, I don't want to dig my hole any deeper right now, but that was where I first saw Noah. The next day, I actually like saw him at like a, what was it, like a Relay for Life or something?
Walk-a-thon.
Yeah. And I can't remember who introduced whom, but then we just started talking and
This is no longer a movie podcast. This is now a Justin and Noah reflecting college experience.
I do think that scene captures, like you said, Alex, like what it's like to be like at college, and also just like for the most part, how open everybody is, because you're all kind of in the same boat of like, I don't know anyone here. And like, this is kind of terrifying, but it's like, it really captures that so well. And it's like the way you can kind of talk to each other as if you've known each other. That's like, and you can't really do that at many other points in your life, but that feels like one of them, at least for me. It felt like that.
Yeah. So, It is a very specific. It's specific to the American university experience, but I do treasure the fact that I had that.
Yeah.
Jeremy, do you remember what happened at the end of the film when, like, we saw it in the theater?
The people screamed louder than they did in No Way Home.
I don't remember.
So in that very last moment, right, where they have this sort of, like, they're high and they're, like, think they're saying something really profound, which is both...
they laugh, right?
Yeah, it's, like, not as profound as they think it is, but is also kind of, like, the thesis of the movie. Some person, like, the loudest person in the world, laughed, like, hysterically at that.
It just came back and then, to,
like,
me.
And then it ended. And I remember being really annoyed. Did that person, like, also partake in the brownie? But, like, now I'm looking back, I can get why that person laughed, right? Because it is, like, so earnest in a way. And
yeah, it's a beautiful humor moment of, like, oh, I can relate to this feeling. Ha, they're so cute. They think that it's everything, but it's not. But yeah. I don't know if that laugh was that, honestly. It kind of felt like, look at these dumb kids, is how I remember it. But
it was a laugh. It was a very abrupt, yeah. It felt judgy, I agree, yeah.
It did.
Also, when Mason says it's always right now, my thought always goes to Spaceballs when Colonel Sanders says, we're at now. And it's, like, not far away from that. It's that kind of...
Justin, are there any last thoughts that you want to say to close this out, or...
Just, you know, this is a beautiful film that has only gotten better every time I've seen it. And, you know, I think I've said before, but it's like, it really is, feels like revisiting an old friend. And I hope to revisit once again, and hopefully with people that I care about. That's the goal.
And Jeremy, you've watched so many classic Linklater movies in the last few weeks. Like, how do you feel like that experience has informed your viewing this time around of this film?
Yeah, I think it's definitely informed it. You know, I think I can feel those themes more. Again, that theme of time, yes, this movie encapsulated, but it's in every one of his movies, whether it's, you know, For the Night. I watched Tape recently. It's all taking place in one room over the course of, like, a couple hours or before sunset, where it's literally happening in real time. His experimentation with this is just, again, I think it's so impactful. I've never seen anyone else capture this in the same way. And it's in all of his stuff. You know, even the first movie that we were discussing before, his first feature from 1988, it's just him traveling around and having kind of aimless conversations and living life and shaving in the mirror. And you think, why would anyone want to watch this? By the end, I was like, this is all, it's all here. All of the blueprint for Linklater's films are in this movie. And I liked it. And it just, he speaks to me, I think, like no other director has yet, at least for me. And I think he'll always have a special place in my heart because of it. And I also think just, I met his work at that pivotal age of around, like, 18, 19 years old, myself going to college and feeling all this. And again, I felt like he was speaking to my experience. And I think that's still the case. He's very, very, I think, very aware of the space to grow and to change, and he wants to be supportive of that, and he likes supporting people who don't necessarily have it all figured out and aren't perfect, and wants to demonstrate that this is what matters. You know, be you, make mistakes, and live life to the most that you can. And I just can't wait to see whatever else he's got coming up. I know he's got a few movies in the line, and I'm just ready to watch them all, honestly.
Yeah, we'll get Merrily We Roll Along in, like, Merrily, another 10 years.
I think more like 15. It says 20 years for this one. So I don't know. Man. Best of luck to Linklater. Let's pray that he makes it through the next 20 years. But
pray that he lives long enough to do this.
Off, then, man, I don't know. He'll go down as the greatest, but we'll see.
He will contractually obligate Lorelei Linklater to do a 50-year project once he's dead.
Be the condition of the estate. Like, you can't get to your trust fund until you complete this 50-year project.
All those sweet Oscar royalties.
All right, well...
Actually, wait, okay, hang on, question. Has Linklater ever been nominated for Best Director? I'm guessing
he was nominated
no.
for Best Director for his film. Yeah, he didn't win, though. This is
okay,
so
he was...
Only...
Okay, all right, okay.
This was his only real, like, Oscar breakthrough. I think he got a screenplay nomination for Before Sunset, but that was it. And there was a number of nominations for Boyhood, but as Justin said at the very beginning, only one win by Patricia Arquette, so which was very well deserved. But I feel like Ethan Hawke deserved it as well. I mean,
it was
Yeah, it
was disappointing. Like, that was the movie it wasn't my number one for that year, but it was the movie I was rooting for the hardest in that Oscar season. It was a disappointment that it only walked away with one.
Yeah. Lost to Birdman. Weird year, if you think about it, that those were the two movies. Like, they're both very formally experimental, and for those to be the two movies that were the frontrunners is pretty interesting. There was no safe choice that year.
And, I mean, Boyhood just holds up so much better than, like, Birdman was fine,
we'll get into this whole thing at some point, I'm sure.
Part two of this episode.
But thank you, Jeremy, for bringing this to our attention, letting us have an excuse to rewatch it and spend an hour and a half talking about it.
Yeah, this is probably the longest we've gone on anything now that I think about it. But we should close it up there for now. So let's talk about where we can find everybody online. And I want to start with you, Jeremy. Is there anything that you'd like to plug or anyone we can find your work?
My Letterboxd account, that's the main thing you could follow. You know, I'm documenting everything that we're doing. Hope we'll see if how long this movie a day goes, but definitely hoping to get all the Linklater stuff up there. And my account is just the letter JMATIC13. JMATIC13 is the way to find me on there.
Okay. Well, then I need to do that because I am not currently.
Yeah, come on.
How about you, Noah?
You guys can check out all my written stuff at francenoir.blogspot.com. And in addition, you should all check out the new podcast that Justin and I are doing with my brother, Podrick Angels The Rush Hour, where we go through the entire discography and maybe filmography of the band Rush. Are there Rush films? I don't know. We'll find out.
Not that I believe anyone in Rush has done, but there are definitely a lot of documentaries about them.
If we start now, Justin, then in 20 years' time, we'll have a masterpiece in our hands.
Yes, and you can find that on thepopbreak.com as part of the Breakcast feed. You can also find me on thecinemaverick.com. That's my website. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. And close this out, Alex. Where can we find your stuff?
You can find my stuff on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow our show on Twitter at Cinema Joes. You can also follow my work as the podcast editor for PopBreak.com by heading over to thepopbreak.com/podcasts. And you can also subscribe to the two podcast feeds that I contribute towards, both PopBreak TV, which hosts my monthly TV break podcast, and The Breakcast, which hosts my Bill versus the MCU, where we are doing a monthly rewatch of all of the MCU.
Awesome. But we want to thank all of our subscribers and listeners. Thank you for sticking with us, and we look forward to giving more content soon. But for now, this is Justin Mancini for the Cinema Joes signing off.
Yeah, that's getting cut from the episode.
Major Alex tangent at this point.
Denying the world my greatest hits.